you. And without further ado, I'd like to introduce Tom Eye from Aberdeen, North Carolina. It's yours, Tom, till 4:30.
Appreciate that warm introduction.
we'll do the oozing tomorrow.
Man, that was heartfelt. Well, good to see you folks. It's good to have you here on a beautiful Sunday afternoon, of which there probably won't be too many more in Salt Lake. So I'm glad to see you. I am just who he said, Tom Ivester, and alcoholic, a member of the Primary Purpose Group in Southern Pines, North Carolina, and I'm delighted to be back here. I'm not sure my voice is going to last as long as my trip, but maybe we'll finish in a dead heat, I hope. And so it is good to see you, and what we want to do is just visit. Let me ask you about the efficiency of this. Will it pick up pretty well? Sounds in the room?
Mm-hmm. You can wander around.
I'd really love to make what we're doing interactive. I think the most useless communication in the world is one-way communication, where you just sort of talk at people. And the retention rate, I understand, will be about 2% in 2 weeks. And none of us will remember 2% of what we did. And if you get involved, it'll go up to 35 or 40. And if you get involved in putting it together, delivering it, it'll go up to about 80. So there's just something about communication, so I would really like to invite you to. I don't have any particular product, method, or anything else I'm trying to sell. Yeah, all I want to do is share with you the experience that I've had and things that I ponder a little bit about our function today, about the trends and developments in our program, some good, some bad, and deal with it around the notion of the home group. We have a little publication, I think, it probably is appropriately titled as anything we have in our literature. It's called Home Group, Heartbeat of AA. And that's literally so, the heartbeat of AA. And by the way, just feel free now, because he said we'll pick up, don't whisper, you know, particularly if it's confidential. Big Brother's got you covered here. and then just feel free to join in. I want to go back and just sort of cite a little bit of history, some of which I was not present for, some of which I was. Having to do with the home group as heartbeat of AA and why that's so importantly true. In 1950, we held our first real convention in Cleveland that took in the entire fellowship. And it became our first, in fact, it was tantamount to our first General Service Conference. And at that conference, the traditions were introduced, but not presented formally. Yeah, but they were prepared in 1950. In 55, we had our second, what became the International Convention, in St. Louis. And this one was a very well-attended thing, and primarily because there was some important stuff coming up. With one thing that happened was that the AA traditions were adopted as the basic principles by which we operate and achieve unity and service in our fellowship. That was an important thing. The other was that up until 1955, even though we didn't have a formal title, Bill Wilson was the leader of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, he was the man in charge. And there was no question in anybody's mind, particularly his, that he was the man in charge. and so he played a vital role in that. He was a visionary leader. I was old enough to have met him. I met him in 65 at the International in Toronto. And that was the primary reason I went, and I achieved what I went for. I didn't want to tell him anything. I just wanted to sort of make sure he was there and not just some character somebody made up. And so did that. But what happened in 55 that was so critical to what we're talking about here today? Bill, in effect and in reality, turned the fellowship over to the membership. When the traditions came into play, turned it over and stepped back as the leader of Alcoholics Anonymous. And what he introduced that day during that conference were the traditions, were the design of the General Service Conference as we know it, that goes once a year in New York, the structure in terms of how the group conscience, which would now be in charge of, I wish we had, we do have a board. let me crudely draw something. I use this one because I want Tony to miss this. This is very important for Tony to hear. What came out of that was what we call the inverted triangle. I hope I'm not messing up somebody's board here. The inverted triangle. Maybe this would be a picture of Alcoholics Anonymous. And then these three poles of this figure are the three legacies of Alcoholics Anonymous. One is recovery. One is unity. Right, service. And when Bill made that decision and it turned the fellowship over, it was built on the notion that the home group would be the driving force in how we took care of the business of Alcoholics Anonymous. And you're talking about the management of a multi-million dollar corporation with tentacles all over the world. And so you're talking about a major management kind of a responsibility. And so the action was that the upside down triangle is that the power would not be here. The decision making, the policy making would not be there. All that would reside there would be the final actions and putting into motion the things that are generated. That the driving force would come not from the top of the pinnacle of this, but from the base of it. That the home group would be the driving force presented by the group conscience. We just got through doing something unsuccessful, I might add, but we just got through doing something that was exactly this process. I don't want to get into too many stories because I won't get to go to jail. And I certainly don't want to miss that. But we, our correctional folk in New York, were gonna do some vital CPC work with corrections, and what they decided to do was spend $65,000 to put together an 8-minute video that would transform the thinking of correctional managers and staff around the world. Now, I was a correctional manager for a long time, and correctional managers, just like anybody else, only 100 times more, get more mail and information than they could possibly handle. And I tried to imagine how on earth is anybody able to look at an 8-minute video and really learn how to cooperate with something called Alcoholics Anonymous. Be lucky to get 10 people in the entire country to even look at it. And so we raised a mighty protest that it was well delivered. It worked. We generated this in a meeting in our home group and said, we don't think this is a good idea. We have a corrections committee in our group. And say, we just don't think that's a good idea. That if you're going to cooperate, that calls for cooperating, for working together. It doesn't mean sending messages back and forth. It means how do we hook together and cooperate. You doing your thing in a way that complements us doing our thing. You can't do that by mail, you know, or send it out by video. We didn't think. Now, that was the group conscience of my own group. If it had been up to us, we wouldn't have spent a cent. You know, we'd have fined them for even thinking about it. It got through the process, and it got all the way up to the conference, and then they decided differently. So we spent $65,000. But that's, even though it was a losing battle, that's exactly the way it worked. My home group, sitting in a church basement, looked at that thing and said, that is not a good idea. And our group conscience spoke. We communicated that to our district committee person, who's the next label, if we were labeled in this thing that way, it'd be the home group, the base down here. We communicated that to our district committee, and our district committeeman took that and gave it to our delegate from the state of North Carolina, and he and I personally, I wanted to lobby him a little bit, so I worked him over pretty good. But he did a good job, because I checked on him. He did a good job. He went down fighting, but he went down. So the conscience spoke. You know. And so when it got to the conference, there were about 134 people representing various parts of Alcoholics Anonymous. 95 delegates from all of the states and Hawaii and territories and stuff. All of them met in convention, along with staff from General Service Office. And so they decided against it. But that was the whole design. And this was what Bill Wilson had in mind when he laid out what I think some of the most visionary planning I've ever seen, of how the traditions were put together, the concept of the conference, the due process of this upside down triangle, brilliant plan. And if you want to see how brilliant it is, if you haven't already looked at it, look at the concepts for World Service. Now I try not to look at them because they're complex. You know, I treat them like law books. I leave them on the shelf till something happens and I need them. Then I know where to get them. But those were written in 1962, I believe. And the vision that's displayed in that is beyond imagination of what happened. And so this plan is what went into place. The key element in this was that our membership would respond and that we would thoughtfully consider the issues confronting Alcoholics Anonymous, and then we would speak. You know, and that would be the driving force of our fellowship. Now, that's a great plan. But I'm sorry to tell you that in my view, that design, while it's excellent, is a lot more fantasy than fact, because it just simply is wounded to the point that I seriously doubt the efficiency of it. And for good reason. The bottom level of that, the home group, has almost become an endangered species. And when you start trying to get a group conscience, number one, you got to have a group. You can't have a meeting conscience. You got to have a group conscience of people who come together and reason together and consider principles of something. And so what we've done over the years is drifted away from that vital role that was envisioned. And gotten to a point where if you look across the country, and I get the opportunity to go to a lot of places, and I never fail to talk to people in that state or wherever I am about what's happening with them in their service structure and about how we do the business of our fellowship. And I wish I could tell you that I find pop pockets of brilliance once in a great while. But believe me, they are very few and far between. When you look at how the group conscience is expressed, what we find is the representation from the home group comes to about 20 to 23% of the registered groups. That's all that participate. So even if it's a wonderful group conscience, just like I was about that video, no matter how good it is, it don't mean a thing if it doesn't go anywhere. And if we didn't have a general service representative to take it on, if we didn't have a home group, it never would have happened. And so we've got a pretty wounded model with that thing. I have a hunch if old Bill just happened to come back and took a look, he'd probably say, "You got to be kidding. Is this what you've done with the mantle, the mantle being passed or whatever?" And I think he would have a case of DTs or something if he took a look. Because it's a troublesome thing. I just had a chance to meet somewhere at a conference with the chairman of our General Service Board. Nice man. He's a Class A trustee, non-alcoholic, but a very, very concerned and involved guy. He's been trying to work with us and with alcoholics for God knows how many years. A wonderful man. And he and I were doing a workshop on CPC, on Cooperative Professional Community. And so, well, I couldn't resist the opportunity. So I had to work on him a lot while I had a chance. To ask him, I said, I want to ask you something, and I hope that you're going to give me an answer different than what I observe. And I told him what I just told you, that when you look at how we do business and how we carry out our function of keeping Alcoholics Anonymous vital, healthy, so that the next alcoholic who walks in our doors finds what Alcoholics Anonymous is supposed to represent. And when we look at that, well, what he said was, is that you, John? My God, I thought I left Lava Rock. Yeah. And so here's a well-informed guy. He travels, he meets with everybody from every state, and we've traveled all over the world. Great guy. And he just kind of shook his head, and he said, Tom, I wish I could tell you something different, but I can't. So it's a real situation. And it only matters if our purpose matters. If our purpose doesn't matter, then who gives a hoot? But if we're concerned about the wellness and the capability of our fellowship to deal with the myriad problems that are confronting alcoholics, they're more complex now than ever. And so if we're concerned about that, the health of how we take care of our fellowship as a whole is extremely important. You know, that's where the production of our literature comes from. That's where decisions are made having to do with our corporate stuff, with we're getting sued or go to court. Those are the people that take care of the business of Alcoholics Anonymous. And when you're in a multi-million-dollar corporation, there's some business. It's unavoidable. And so it is an extremely vital thing. And so, to me, that's a core concern of mine, that I want Alcoholics Anonymous to be better when I leave than it was when I got here. I want to do that. I mean, how could I justify anything less? Now, I don't want to be somebody who drags it down. I want to be somebody who helps push it forward. And so that's why I have some concern about this kind of thing, because it's a troubling thing. And it's a product. I'm just going to hurriedly run through just some ideas and notions that I have about, you know, why are we in this position? Why would we have the responsibility to carry out our business like this and to have a strong group conscience based on a home group of thoughtful members? Well, why would it be such a concern? Well, if you, I'll give you just one example. I don't want to identify it because I was in a place where the country was made up of one huge island, and they asked me to do, I was amazed, they asked me to do a workshop on home group. And this is a wonderful, wonderful island, it's a wonderful place. People pay a lot of money to go hang out there and all that. Wonderful place. And they want me to do a workshop on Saturday morning. I said, my God, man, people are not going to come out of paradise on Saturday morning to talk about home group. Fill the hall. They must have been lonely or something. But here they were. Yeah. So we had a good workshop. We really had a good time. And at the end of the meeting, two different guys came up to me and said, they said essentially the same thing, that on that entire island, with all of the groups, all of the meetings that occurred on that island, there was only one that they would call a home group in the terms we were talking about. Only one. You see why that would be a little alarming when you're trying to get a group conscience? You know, what would you get out of that island? You'd get the minority opinion of one group, which may have absolutely nothing to do with what your home group would be, or what mine would be, or what the other groups on that island would be. It's just an isolated deal. So what we wind up in reality is, it really is a minority opinion. When you got 20 to 23% of the groups responding and participating in the process, it's a minority opinion, and troubling just from that aspect. A lot of us back away from that. I tell you what I think happened, and then I want to get to some closure just on at least a couple of positive things. I'm not going to get too negative on anything. It'll sound negative, but it's really not underneath. kind of like if you go to a doctor. It's all right if he tells you how sick you are, if he's got a solution. But if he doesn't have a solution, I don't want to hear it. But I think you got to do that. We had to get awful sick before we started to get well. And I think that's what this is about. You know, I think what happened, and there are probably a thousand different opinions of what happened. What happened that we started to veer in a different direction? Now, there's not just one isolated thing that causes it. But I think the biggest impact on Alcoholics Anonymous that had the impact of change in how we function, you know, and how we meet and how we take care of each other, was the emergence of treatment. And you know, sometimes I think we just beat treatment like it was an evil entity or something. But you know, I'm one who is deeply grateful for treatment. I never went through it. I predated that. But I'm deeply grateful for it, because I think in many cases it's been an absolute lifesaver for folk. I think it has helped people get sober earlier than they might have otherwise. So I'm deeply grateful for the existence of it. I've got absolutely no ill feelings whatsoever. I had the experience, and I wouldn't recommend it, of holding an alcoholic in my arms on a 12-step call while he died. And there was nowhere I could take him. Nowhere. Do that, it'll make you very appreciative of having some, when treatment came into being, and you had decent, dignified, professional care. Really meant something to me. Now, it didn't mean enough that I wanted to go check in, but I sent a lot of other people, though, so I was grateful for it. But like, nearly always a little bad news if you look for it. And what happened when treatment hit, it just took off. You talk about a major, you didn't have to market it. There was such a compelling need around. And then when a little bit of money got mixed up in it, treatment started to just balloon all over the place. And there came a day, I wouldn't have believed it would have ever happened. When if I took an alcoholic to the hospital, they'd want to put me in jail. We went from that to a point where in the United States, there was treatment readily available, accessible to almost any alcoholic anywhere in this country. That's an amazing thing. I never believed it. It was a platform in a presidential campaign one time. And alcohol and drug problems was a major platform. So it was a huge kind of hi, got your time for the collection. it was a major kind of a thing, a wonderful news that this started to occur all over. But what happened was, well, there were a couple of things that were sort of troubling. One of them I'm not going to explore too much today. But there were some real impacts on Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, if you, and some of you might have been here, but what preceded treatment was this, our program was characterized not by think tanks, but it was characterized by intensely active work with other alcoholics. During that period, probably the first half of our existence, you could pretty safely say that every alcoholic who came to this program, everyone, that's almost true, closer to true than false, almost everyone came in as a direct result of another alcoholic reaching out, leading them in. And what was bred in that was an unbelievable loyalty. That, you know, whatever they said was law. It didn't make any difference what it was. And it was an inseparable kind of a thing. The sponsorship that came out of that was enormously, enormously important. When treatment came up, that started to change. And in all honesty, I personally just don't think we dealt with it very well. You know, rather than finding ways to cooperate. You know, when a treatment emerged, it's like any new thing, we're suspicious for a while. Yeah, what are they up to? Yeah. And you started hearing grumbling and grousing in the ranks of AA. But what are these people doing? They're doing the same thing we're doing and charging money for it. Yeah. Real upset folk about that kind of thing. They're taking our drunks away from us, you know, all kind of stuff. And so you got this sort of hostile attitude about people help with drugs. And so we didn't do well. And it's just like we always have two options, at least. One is to either to respond to a situation, you know, to take it in and then respond to how can we deal with this. That's one way. That's a healthy way. The other is to react. And that's just back off and throw rocks, you know. And we opted for the latter. And so, but what happened, you know, like if we were used to having, and I was here for all of that, you know, so I could report first person on that. If we were used to alcoholics coming in that door, well, when treatment came up, they started coming in over here. And we didn't adapt to that. You know, we're still looking at that door and cussing treatment because they're coming in over here. Sometimes take it out on the patient. I had a 33 or something I sponsored the dude. So he's an old timer. He was one of the older members of AA. And he talked to me one day. Well, in fact, he talked to a patient kind of ugly, and I talked to him about it. And he said, well, you know good and well those people are not serious. I mean, it wasn't even worth talking about. You know, I said, who cares? You, who cares? That's an alcoholic coming in our door. We don't give Rorschach tests to determine credibility or something. Christ almighty, what we're looking for is broken lives. That's fresh meat, man. Who cares what they are? When people come out of treatment, what they are is in their first day of recovery. Treatment is not recovery. You know, it's sort of lowering the defenses so you can engage in treatment better. And so we literally got a place we got ugly with the alcoholics coming in. You know, we had groups, some of which I was acquainted with, not mine, but we had groups that literally asked treatment centers not to refer patients to their meetings. Is that moving away from what our purpose is? When anyone anywhere reaches out for help, we want the hand of AA to be a, no, we want it to be a clean hand. We want it to be a pure hand, one untouched by sin or something. I don't know. But anyway, that's what we did. And so we started to back away and get in, not cooperation, but into sort of combative thinking. And I tell you the kind of thing, the loyalty started to shift. What I mean by that is that, you know, I mentioned that when all we were doing was 12-step work. That loyalty was absolutely unimpeachable. And, excuse me, now it's not a cold, it's bronchitis, but it's just as noisy. So I apologize, I'm safe to kiss, so sorry. But things started shifting like that. And I'll give you a case that I handled one time. You can see exactly what I'm talking about. A young businessman there in town asked me about sponsorship. And I knew him, as you know people in a small town. I knew who he was and his dog's name and all that. But I didn't know him well. I knew that he was an AA, but he was one of those floater types, you know, that didn't really have a base anywhere. He just sort of flitted around from one place to another. So I knew him, and I knew that he wasn't the reincarnation of the founder. But he was sober, and so he asked me about sponsorship. And as I always do, I said, we'll have to talk. And it's going to be a minimum two-hour conversation before I take on anybody. And so we met, and he started telling me about himself, and we started discussing what sponsorship's about and what our relationship's about and how it'll work. And at one point he said, would you like to know who my current sponsor is? I said, not really. It doesn't matter to me who it is. I said, tell me if you want to, but I couldn't care less. Well, I just thought I couldn't care less. His sponsor was a non-alcoholic counselor in a treatment center and had been for 13 years. And I sat there in shock. How could you miss it that far? And I said, after I just quieted down, I said, let me suggest one thing to you. You've never had a sponsor. What you had was the world's longest aftercare plan. He said, you know, I think that's right. And it was, his umbilical was still attached to the treatment center, for God's sake. Probably wouldn't amaze you to know the fella had never had a home group. He never had a service position. He had never sponsored one soul. He'd never done anything but just flit from one meeting to another, taking care of the selfish needs. Well, God knows, if that's all you do in AA, you miss the whole show. But that's who he was. So I told him if he properly discontinued that fellow, I'd take him on. And I said, now before you get into sponsorship with me, I got to give you some warnings, like you do with a beverage. So you put a warning label on it. So there's a warning label on this. Number one, you're going to have a home group. It doesn't have to be mine, but you're going to have one. You're going to do some service. The more you don't like it, the more you're going to have to do it. Yeah, but you're going to have to do some service. You're going to have to sponsor some people. And he kind of blanched a little. I thought he was going to check it out. And he said, I'll do it. Well, anyway, but if you see what I'm talking about, you know, what was happening in the fellowship, you know, that was a very, very important link that went away. And in the course of it, we also got that thing that just kind of blanked out, you know, how we were accustomed to work with alcoholics. The other thing that happened that's even more germane to what we're talking about here, you could safely predict that if a treatment center opened anywhere, the number of AA meetings would double almost overnight. Because what was coming out, you know, with treatment was the term that we became familiar with, 90 and 90. Well, if you're in a town or, you know, rural, kind of a low income, yeah, we're poor over there. You may want to take up a love offering before I leave here so I get back to poor old North Carolina and able to eat. No, I'm not. I've got more than I need. But in towns like that, if you go do 90 and 90, you better have a Learjet. Because they ain't there, you know. And so if they're not there, do you want people to do 90 and 90? Well, you do. You encourage them to start their own meetings. You know? And so we started to just see this mushrooming of meetings starting. And they bore a remarkable resemblance to aftercare groups. You know, where you basically talk in, how's your day? How's it going? What are you doing now? Did you do this? You know, just almost like an aftercare thing. And so you started to get this proliferation of that kind of meeting. And it exists to this day. Now, you know, it doesn't have quite the same connotation it did when it started out, but it's an extremely popular thing, extremely popular. If you don't believe it, try to convert one of those to a group. You better pack a lunch, because you're going to have a hard time doing it. You know, those things are really tend to be put together on the level of convenience. You know, find an awful lot of them that are happy hour, lunchtime, you know, this kind of stuff, so you can just sort of grab what you get and get on out the door. And the problem with that is that they tend to be one-dimensional. The only, you know, I mentioned three legacies that make up our program. You could pretty safely say that in a meeting like that, the only legacy you're going to hear is recovery. That's going to be the topic 99% of the time. And that's fine. That's a great place to start. Ain't much of a place to just start, to stop. And so when you look at that, with that kind of growth of that, you can imagine, it doesn't take any imagination to see what happened to this viable construct that Bill laid out, where each of our groups would study the issues, search the hearts, the group conscience, and then express what our group feels. How would you do that in a brown bag meeting, you know, where you rush in and then you got to get right back to work? You're not going to do it, you know. And so, you know, that's one of the problems that we really face. That's a byproduct of that kind of thing. Those things are really popular because they'll tend to be focused on me and my needs. Who doesn't appreciate that? Downside is that the value of the meeting is limited to the meeting itself. Nothing precedes it, and nothing follows it. You know, a couple of folks might say, let's grab a coffee. But there is no life before or after. You just come together, have joy and hour together, go your separate ways. You know, it's not a group of alcoholics in action. It's just a group of alcoholics in visitation or something, you know. And so you can imagine trying to fit that into what Bill's concept was. And that's why we see, 20 to 23% even bothering to show up. All too often, groups that meetings like, well, group, it doesn't matter what you call it. We have the most generous definition of group in Alcoholics Anonymous that could possibly be imagined. I mean, it could not be looser. I don't think. Two or more. In fact, my definition, you don't even have to have two. The definition, I heard a group one time that it's two or more people, one of whom doesn't have to be present. And that's true, isn't it? That if I've got a real committed relationship with my wife, we're a group. I know that I'm in her mind, because she doesn't know what I'm doing in Salt Lake. She may think I get young and frisky again. I know I'm on her mind. She's home watching the dog, the grandchild. But I forgot where it was. The notion that you simply couldn't conceive of how that's going to come out of that kind of a deal. And so that's what we deal with. And so it's a very popular thing. And just like I mentioned a while earlier, if you start trying to change a meeting into a group, it is truly a hard job. I've done it. And I'm a group man, 100%. I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous in a strong group. And thank God for it, because I've been sober since day one. Thank God for that. I was introduced in a group where they planfully helped alcoholics get into recovery, introduced them to the program of recovery, me one of them. And I'll be ever grateful for that, that I wasn't in just some gaggle of folks telling war stories. Yeah, that it was actually a root group where we were talking about a solution to a problem. So you always feel sort of loyal to your origin, whatever it is. And so I feel I'll always be a member of that original home group. I just don't want to be a regular member. It was in a jail, so I was not overly fond of the notion of being a permanent member. I'm a visitor once in a while. But so it's always been in me. I've never failed. I've never been absent being a member of a group. And when I got into my professional life, I got moved around a little bit. And so every time I would move, I would look for a group. And now I've got a criteria for a group. I'm not just looking for a warm, fuzzy, friendly place, where there's some nice, interesting people. I'm looking for a group of alcoholics in action. I'm interested in a group where all legacies are on full charge, and where there's enthusiasm, where there's life, and there's action going on. That's what I'm looking for. In all honesty, for the last 30 years, every time I have moved, I have been totally unable to find a group that even came close to that criteria. The place in the book that Pete knows where it is, I don't. But I think it's in the vision there where it's talking about if you get into a town and there's nobody there but you. I've been that guy. What do? You create the fellowship you crave. And so if you can't find it, now I've gone through that thing of trying to convert groups, and I've never succeeded. The converted meetings group, never succeeded. I was in one, I worked on it 5 years before it dawned on me I was trying to impose my will on a group of people that wasn't going to hear it. I couldn't get anything done. I wanted to move the podium. You notice Pete and I fussing over where to sit. It's important where you sit. I started sitting down there and I realized I couldn't see you. I just don't trust alcoholics I can't see. I want to be looking in those beady little eyes, I went in this group and they had the podium so far back you felt like you were in a different room. Well, my God, I handled podiums enough. I know that's wrong. I'd move it. One man group conscience, I'd move it. I'm a son, got to come back next meeting. It's right back where it was. It took me 5 years to catch on. And those folks built what fit them. They're not going to let some fast-talking Yankee from somewhere coming there to convert it, you know. And so, I mean, it's just an awfully impossible task. What I've had to do, and God knows it's 8:30. What time is it in Salt Lake? Oh, thank you. That's for poor people up there. Okay. All right, great. We're going to quit it. Where do we quit? 4:30? Okay. All right, great. All right. So let me tell you what I've done. So if you don't find that, you know, what do you do? And I've started a lot of groups. You know, I've started a lot of groups, you know, trying to carry the message in facilities and stuff like that. I've started a ton of groups. What I usually do, well, just like that one where I gave up on moving the podium, when I finally saw that we weren't going anywhere, there were two or three other disgruntled types like me in the room, and we find each other. And I knew who was moaning and groaning. So I said, well, why don't you do something about it? What? Let's start a group. So we started a group. Now, this is just my belief, but I believe when you go and start a group, there needs to be a purpose. You know, what are you trying to do with this group? You know, a lot of times, you know, I think we fall into a bad trap by saying, let's just start a group and see what happens. Let's just start a group, have good meetings, and then see who shows up. You know, that, to me, is a very awkward way to start a group if you want it to be a real group. And so usually, the first group, when I left that group with the movable podium, and one of the goofiest guys, I sponsored this guy, 12-stepped him. And when I was 12-stepping him, I thought I was having DTs because I kept seeing something running in the room. And I said, you got an animal in here? He said, oh, yes, my ferret. Ferret. I said, good God, man, can't you get a dog like people do? You're a ferret, a stupid thing. Anyway, that's who he was. Fortunately, I don't want to make you uneasy, but finally he moved to Colorado. but he was one of our founders, and his wife was another, and he had one more. So we had four people. What we wanted to do, we wanted a big book. We started a group that was built around the book. The other thing we wanted to do was build a home group, a place where people felt a sense of belonging. Now, that was our purpose. And so that told us what kind of a group to build. You know, what can we put together? Then it's going to attract people who are interested in that. We very deliberately scheduled it at the same time as the group we were leaving because we didn't want to transplant the nomads, you know, the folks who just wandered around. We didn't want to transplant folks. We wanted people who were looking for something different. And so we started a group. That group still meets. It's over 30 years old. And so we started for that purpose. And so it's still the big book group, and it still does exactly that. It creates that sense of belonging, and it does real well. Then a thing happened that led to the group I'm in now, and I'm not introducing this as a model of what a group ought to look like. It's what a group looked like for a group of people who were looking for a particular thing. You know, sometimes you look around and you just get aggravated and concerned about something. I was watching the astronomical failure rate in Alcoholics Anonymous. I got so sick of watching people coming in, desperate looking, and then walk out over and over and over. And I got sick of that. I got sick and tired. And I'm not somebody who likes to moan and groan and complain. If you hear me complain about something, you better watch what I'm doing because I guarantee you I'll be trying to do something about it next. And I'm not going to be a victim inside my fellowship. And so when I've got a problem, I'm going to try my best to come up with a solution. So I started looking at that. I thought, what on earth can I do? I mean, that's a rampant problem all over the country. Well, I'm one guy in one group. And so I stumbled on a way to take people through the big book a little different than I'd been doing. You know, I've been taking people through steps for God knows how long, and I've done it. I've done it Marine Corps style. You know, where you do it. It's going to take 14 weeks, 1 week more than that, and you're out of here. You know, that kind of authoritative kind of stuff, and other ways. You know, one on one, and then with the other things. And all of them had some effect, but none of them really had major impact. And a guy told me about the way he was doing it, and it made sense. And key thing was it when you go through the book, what you try to do is make the, not that book, but try to make the big book become not the story of Bill and that first 100, but my story, so that what's in that book becomes my story. And she's got a novel here. Isn't that a novel?
Oh,
it is? Is that a big book?
It's a big book.
She's got it decorated
with
a bunch of foosy stuff on there. So if you don't like it, quit. But I found his way to do the book, and it was amazing to me. It worked. And the first one we took a gang of people through. 15 completed the entire program. And it really verified to me what it says in chapter 5. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Bill Wilson said if he had changed anything in the book, he would have changed rarely to never. If they thoroughly followed. I found exactly that. We went through and with 15 people who made every session, every one of them is sober today. Every one of them. And that's probably been close to 15 years ago. And they are still sober. I'm not a magic bullet guy, but I believe exactly what Bill said, that if you really and truly get in close and do these principles to the best of your ability, there's no room for failure. There's no room. And I think slips are an aberration. Yeah. And the people that left, we had one of the people that left committed suicide, which is not an uncommon outcome for people who don't get into recovery. Not uncommon at all. And so... I saw something with that. And what happened when people complete an experience like going through the book and having a profound experience in transformation, they get fired up.
Yeah.
You know, like it says in the book, a place there, your imagination will be fired. And that's what happens, you know, when people go through and they really take full bore and lay it and take the actions laid out in that book, it'll fire you up. And so that bunch of the rascals that finished it, the groups they were in were not adequate vehicles for that energy. And so they were getting frustrated because there was no outlet, you know, that where they could, they weren't creative enough to go find one. But they would just kept bugging me about starting a group that would channel that energy. I was the founder of the group I was in. I said, no, man, that'd be like the captain jumping the ship. I'm not going to leave my group. And then they kept beating on me, and then I saw the other group was doing fine. So we started. And I'll give you a quick snapshot of how we started that group. And like I say, it's not a prototype, but it's a very successful process. Now I'm an action type of guy. I'm not one for long study groups and doing a lot of research and stuff. I like to get it on, you know, if you got some idea about what to do. So we started to develop a group. Had 10 people that wanted to be in on developing a group. 9 guys, 1 woman. So we met didn't hold a meeting, we just met in the back of a guy's place of business to talk about the formation of a group. They asked me to lead the meeting, and so I decided to do a brainstorming thing. You know what I mean, where it's a quick thinking thing. Brainstorming, I love that, because what I find is that my first thought is almost always my best. And once I run it back through the censor and editorialize it all, I'll screw up anything. You know, if I think about it long enough, I'll screw it up. And so I like brainstorming because you just throw it out what you really think without running it through the censor. And so I'd explain what brainstorming was, then I let it off because you always got to prime the pump a little bit, you know. So I just threw out structure. And in brainstorming, no explanation. Unless it's in a foreign language or something, but it's no explanation. You throw it out, and no questions. You know, unless you just think, what does that spell? You know, something like that. There is no conversation. And in 12 minutes, we came up with 20 what we called goals. What I asked everybody to do was think of a quality, a component, an ingredient that you would insist on having in a group. It would make you feel good that you would insist on having. Everybody had one. And in 12 minutes, you know, we just raced them out. You know, it came down. We haven't changed them one iota this day. We did reduce them from 20, because we had a little bit of unnecessary language in it, and we boiled it down to 12. 12 seemed to be a popular number at AA. So we just brought it down to 12 so it fit, you know, and wouldn't look like it was from outer space. No, it just said it better. And it hasn't changed a bit. And so when we got through it, you can imagine what they'd be. If we did it right here, I guarantee you we'd come up close to the same thing. They wanted stuff to come out of the conference-approved literature. That we wanted meetings to stay on track. We wanted to have speaker meetings once a week and that there be diversity in them. That they not all be tall, good-looking guys like me. That and get some ugly people, too. You've got Pete's coming one day. Women, black, white, Spanish. We had guys speaking Spanish one night. Nobody knew what he said but him. We had a good time. And that gay, straight, it doesn't matter. You know, but we want it to look like America. That's what our group is. Our group's America. But just stuff like that we wanted to put in. Well, when you've got what you want, putting a group together is a no-brainer because you figure out what you want to do. And so if you want those things to happen, how do you make them happen? One of the things we said, I'm looking at you because you're a little bit younger than me, a little bit. You probably came in young. We wanted a newcomer group that gave new people coming into the program a sound introduction to AA. We wanted it to happen. And so that was just typical of the kind of thing we're doing. And so in order to deliver on those services, what we did was set up, we had 10 people, and we didn't calculate it this way, but we set up service committees. You know, every committee, every service entity that exists in Alcoholics Anonymous exists in my home group. We have CPC, a committee on CPC, PI, treatment, corrections, have a newsletter, a newcomers committee. On everything we wanted to meet, we set up a structure that would deliver what we were looking for. And we were off and running. You know, as we got through with that, and we had all those committees named up there, we used that wheel, you know, with Joe and I, all this stuff would look. Somebody said, "Where on earth are we going to get members for that many committees?" I said, "My God, man, it's already solved." "What do you mean?" I said, 10 of us, 10 of them. Pick one. Well, it was done. Every committee was full. All you had to do was add members. And that's what we did. Yeah. And so we were off and running. It's amazing. You know, with a game plan, you don't have to figure out what to do. You're already doing it. You know, all you got to do is deliver it. You deliver it. And so, man, we were off and running. And I don't know, I mean, I'm not a magical thinker, but with I guess the word gets around in a smaller community. The first night we met, we had over 40 people, the first night. The next night we met, we meet twice a week. Next night we met, we had to move without authorization. We had to move to another location to accommodate the crowd. Now, we haven't become the International Convention. We live in a small town. But typically on Thursday night at our open speaker meeting, we'll have somewhere close to 100 people. And now not many more than that in our town. You know, I think somebody's sneaking in. But it just worked. You know, newcomer meeting, I keep pointing to him because he looks young. He got his hair frizzed up. He got to be young. MG does. He's not even young. We got a newcomer guy. The newcomer guy came over to me after we'd been meeting 3 or 4 weeks, and he said, "Can I ask you something?" I said, "What?" He said, "We ain't got no newcomers." I said, "Well, what do you think we ought to do about it?" And I said, "Why don't you start a newcomer meeting?" He said, "Didn't you understand what I said? We ain't got no newcomers." I said, "Start a newcomer meeting." He said, "You're crazy." I said, "We'll do it anyway. Just go ahead and start one." Well, what he didn't know, but I did, that just like folks showed up on that first night, we had a number of facilities in our immediate area, And people who have alcoholics in captivity are hungry for some place to take them. And what you're trying to do is get them introduced to AA. And when you say newcomer, what that says is, y'all come. Y'all come. And the first night that newcomer met, that boy thought I was a genius for a little while. First night it met, we had over 40 newcomers in there. And 11 years later, we will still have anywhere from 25 up to 40 in that room. But it's a plan executed. You see what I'm talking about? It's a thing. People don't have to worry about what to do. And so every one of those things, I'm chairman of the correction facility. We have election July for that one, and I ran unopposed and just narrowly won. I won my one vote. No, that's a lie. They voted for me pretty heavy. But that's what we do. And so it goes without saying, I had people said they wanted a vehicle for their energy. You think they found one in that? I guarantee you, if somebody doesn't have a job there, you've been hiding. Because we've got a ready market. A newcomer can come into our group and he can be on a committee the next week. He may not be president of it, but he can lick stamps. He can help carry the book. It won't be long. He'll be doing more than that. And so it's a great vehicle, you know, for getting people into action without having to throw them in over their head in water too deep. It's a great way to introduce folks. And so we have as you gathered, I gave you an example. We have an active group. When our assembly's coming up, our GSR leads a meeting where we go over the agenda for our assembly. And our group goes on record with either opposing or offering something that we think's better on that stuff. You know, we participate in what Bill was talking about. Looks like we lose a lot of battles, but at least we're fighting. You know, we're going to be in the fight. And so it's just worked out great. You know, some Al-Anons came in and set up a meeting same night we met, which was great because it's a family illness and it's a family program of recovery. And sometimes we totally boxed the family out. And so we were really pleased when they came in and we were able to get that feature in the group. So I'm delighted with it. You know, I'm like a kid at Christmas. 11 years, we're coming up. Next time we'll be 12 years next June. And I'm just deeply, deeply pleased with what that group does, not only for the members, but for AA in general around in our area. To me, that's what's important about the group. I went through that little drill I'll give you any information you want on that, but I don't sell nothing. You know, I guarantee you anything I got's for free. And so I'm not peddling anything. I'm not trying to push some new discipline. But if you want to do something with the group, you'd be interested in more about this, I'll email you whatever we've got. I don't lick stamps anymore. I about wore my tongue out licking stamps and doing duck. But it just has been an extremely, extremely helpful thing. Awfully hard to get bored in that group. Because one guy came and speak there the other night, and he said, I'll tell you one thing. If you don't want to get busy in AA, don't even stand next to Tom Ivester. I said, gee, you'll have a job. And now I'm not that bad, but he's pretty close to truth. That's the nature of the group. So that's what we want. We don't want a think tank. We don't want to get off in a whole bunch of stuff and all of this. You just sort of take care of ourselves. What we want to do is carry out our primary purpose, and that's to carry the message to the alcoholic still suffers. So that's what we're in business to do. And that's why we're vitally involved in the things of the program. Let me take a deep breath and just see if anybody has comments, questions, or whatever. Yeah, I'd be delighted to hear from you. Don't want to just filibuster you. Yeah. Anybody? Thoughts? Yeah. Notions? Hey.
As a newcomer, I kind of felt that. My recent experience with treatment coming out. And
speak up just a little bit.
As a newcomer, you know, going to groups and things like that, I was desperately looking for somewhere I could belong, where I could just, you know. And I didn't feel that the first couple of weeks I was out there after treatment.
Yeah.
But it makes me feel better that people are thinking along these lines.
Yeah.
You know, that it's happening. Yeah. It's not just something I'm imagining, that the newcomer is, mm-hmm. you know, like the things I listen to.
Yeah.
I'm grateful to hear
yeah,
that.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks very much. I tell you, you hit it right. That an AA meeting can be one of the loneliest places on earth. Right. It truly can. Because we don't mean to do it. But when we meet, we're glad to see each other. And we'll get so caught up in talking with each other that we'll have some poor soul that walked in that doesn't even know if we're in the right place and leave untouched. You know, and that's sad, but it's true. It's absolutely true. And that's why I like a group that's got some solidity to it, because a group will tend to be sensitive to the things going on. Just a casual gathering of people are not going to have that kind of sensitivity. You know, if it's not a group and you don't have a sense of belonging, who has the responsibility to welcome somebody? Because usually but the majority of folk are visitors from somewhere, not really members. So I think it is vital for that reason to get newcomers. And I'll tell you one other thing we do in that group along the newcomer line. We have a committee of about 14 people. All the leadership is contained within that committee. So we don't just yank somebody in and go work with a newcomer. We don't do that. We've got a group. They help put together the agenda for the coming meetings. We encourage anybody with less than 6 months to go to the newcomer group. We very strongly encourage people with more than 6 months to not go to the newcomers group. Because so often happens, newcomers groups get absorbed by older members. And they're not being mean. That a lot of them just are hungry to work with some new people. A lot of, frankly, some are just sort of hiding from going further in the program. It's a lot easier to hang there and talk about the entry information than it is to start stretching and growing. But a lot of newcomers groups fail because they're just totally warped out of shape by an inordinate involvement of other people. I try to set an example. I care deeply about the newcomer group. I've never been in it. Never been in it. Because if I do, I'm the oldest rat in the barn. And if I go in, first thing I'm going to do is pull people's attention away from that. I don't have to do anything. They'll just think I'm getting ready to say something. Yeah. And so I stay away. You know, I want those folks there, and if they need me, they'll call me. And otherwise, I'm going to get out of the way. So it is. It's vital. That's the lifeblood of AA. And you can, well, I'll give you, you don't have to be a newcomer to do it. You can run into, probably everybody here knows, you can walk into an AA meeting, you think you're in a wake or something. I went to a meeting. Every group, particularly if it's not a group, nobody feels responsibility to welcome people because everybody just casually comes. And so nobody feels that sense. I went in to speak to a group a while back down in a little town near where I live. Now, I met people when I came in here. I shook him, met Tony. And Tony's a better man since we met, I can tell. Shook hands. Tony lit up. You know, he was, but I met him. You know. And when I do that, And that's not because I'm selling anything. I am selling. Well, tell you what happened. Went out and speak to that group, and it's that weird thing that happens in a group sometimes. It looked like a dance, you know, that all people were lined up around the walls waiting for the music or something. They're standing there just sitting looking at each other. Well, I thought, this is silly. So I go around, and I start, you know, like they're the receiving line for the president or something. I go around and start meeting everybody. And I met a woman, and she seemed kind of excited to meet somebody. And so I got about halfway around the room, and she came across the floor, and she tapped me. She said, "Can I ask you a personal question?" I said, "Well, sure, you ask me a personal question. What is it?" She said, "What do you do? You know, what do you sell? You know, what do you sell?" And I said, "Nothing. You know, I'm unemployed." But then I caught myself. And I said, "Oh, yeah, yes, I do sell something. I sell recovery. And, man, we got a deal on that thing." You know what I mean? She said, "That's what I'm doing. You know, I'm selling recovery. And, you know, no price for it. So we got a good deal on it. But that's what I do. Because I want somebody, when they come in here, to know they're in the right place. I don't care if they're a newcomer, if they're 50 years. I want them to know they're in the right place." And you can literally, if you haven't traveled much, you may not be aware of that. But it's easy to find. Is to walk in and be untouched by anybody. I'll give you just one other example of that. That the again, I won't name the town, but I went in, I was like the psychiatrist at the burlesque show. I went in, and I was not going to watch the performers. I wanted to work the audience a little bit. And this was a typical clubhouse scene, mid-afternoon. Bunch of folks in there playing dominoes or poker or telling lies or whatever. They're just doing that usual stuff that you do, hanging out, it's killing time. I went around and deliberately made physical contact with every person in that room. I didn't miss anybody. Went over to the bar. Not a soul responded. Not a single soul said, "Oh, you're new around here." Nobody said anything. Just kept on doing what they're doing. Is that what I want AA to look like? Good God. But I was on a mission. Went over to the bar, and the guy that was handling the coffee bar was talking to another guy. I sat there for a few minutes. Didn't want to create any ruckus. Finally, he said, "You want something?" I said, "Yeah, I'd like a cup of coffee." So I got a coffee and paid for it. And I went back to the hotel. I was on a business deal. Went back to the hotel, and I was going to come back and go to a meeting that night. So I went in that club. Now, rather than being a psychiatrist, I went in like an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Same crowd sitting there. They had moved. I think they were frozen in place. They just sat there in the chair. I went around, interrupted every conversation, every game, whatever to do, and I interrupted every one of them. Tom Iverson from North Carolina. They probably couldn't have given a rat's fanny who I was or where I was from. It didn't look like it did. But I did that with everybody in that room. You believe me, that was a different club. That was a different club. Because people started to wake up and come out of that coma or whatever it was they were in and started to wake up. They had a brand new member, brand new, that day, that wanted to go to a meeting. I'm out of town. Who you suppose they asked to take him to a meeting? Yeah. You better believe it. You're not going to wake up some dummy and say, "Hey, get up from there. You got a new one to invigorate." Newcomer had to carry him. Yeah. So, see what I'm talking about? You know, and so that's a vital part to me of a group, of having assurance that when people come in, they're not going to be overlooked. You know? And so we want it to be a warm, welcoming place, and that's our task to do that. I'll give you one other example, and since you're not going to talk back to me, dangerous not to, but I'll fill the gap. I'll give you one other example about what's critical about this sort of thing. I was in a meeting, and I know some of you, I know you probably heard me talk about this, but I thought it was a definitive kind of an experience. That I was sitting in a workshop. In fact, I did a little presentation at a community workshop, not an AA thing, but I did a presentation at a community workshop. And the panel right behind my presentation was three people from a mental health clinic. And, I mean, you predicted, but they were talking about the challenges of working with people in mental health clinic. The last guy that got up was a psychiatrist. And I swear to God, he was the most tired-looking man I have ever seen in my life. I mean, he just looked like he was dying on his feet. And he charged up to the microphone about one plodding step at a time. And then he started to talk. And he's a psychiatrist at the mental health center. And he said... I would really... Now, there were some AA people sitting in that room. I knew some sitting in there. He said, "I really need some help." He said, "I work with a lot of people who have problems with alcohol. And I believe that AA is the place to send those folks if they're going to get any help." He said, "But honest to God, it seems like when I send them there, they come back worse." And he said, "What's wrong?" And now I'm sitting there wanting the local to answer, you know. I mean, I'm somebody from out of town. What do I know? And again, resounding silence. So somebody needed to answer the man. And since nobody did, I'm somebody. So I, yes?
Can I answer that question?
Yeah, sure. Ask me loud.
Honest, they can recover.
I couldn't agree more. I agree with your statement. It's not a question. I agree with your statement. I agree with that. I don't agree with it. I know it. Man, I've seen some folks that look like they just fell out of the spaceship come in here and get well. And so, yeah, they can. And that guy knew it, too. He believed that it was the place. But when he sent people out, they're coming back worse. You know, what he said, help. Well, what are you going to do, stonewall it? They say, well, if they're mentally challenged, they can recover. That's not a good enough answer. So what we said, well, I stuck my hand up and said, I hate to get back up and talk again, but I know you're serious and you want some help. And I said, I think I understand what you're talking about. I said, one thing you got to realize is that everything that flies the AA flag is not the same thing. Now, he didn't know. He's not a member. It's not the same thing. You got some things that fly the AA flag, and it is a flagship. And you got others that ought to be a submarine, you know. But see, there's no commonality. There's no real predictable kind of thing. And so what he's doing is sending people blind draw to meetings with no clue what it is. And I swear to God, I don't need to tell you if you go to very many meetings. You go to some meetings that'll make you need a psychiatrist. I mean, my God, man, it sounded like the Jerry Springer show or something, you know, with a bunch of goofy stuff. And, well, of course they're going to come back worse. My God, you get somebody that's borderline, what do you call it when you think they have people after you?
Paranoid,
yeah. That's good for newcomers. Right on. You're better already just talking about a newcomer. That's great. Yeah. Yeah, you go. Yeah, but the man is very sincere, and he's dealing with people's lives. And so I told him, everything's not the same thing. And I said, I don't live here, but I know the terrain. I said, what I would recommend to you is that you get to know maybe two AA members right around this area that you trust. And when you've got a guy that you're trying to place, call them and ask them where you need to refer them. And that way you're going to get it from somebody who knows. And you're not going to take a paranoid guy and put him in a Jerry Springer show. You know, you're somebody that's borderline, just losing it with deep depression. You're not going to put him in somebody. You know, if you get somebody thoughtful and say, here's a group that you can go in and it's going to be solution-oriented. But somebody had to say that to him. Somebody also has to deliver. And I'll tell you, that the ready availability of good sound groups where you can very comfortably refer somebody is a shrinking reality. Right now, I mean, I hate to say it, it's my fellowship, and I want to try to help fix it. But right now, if somebody asks me, I get a lot of calls from people asking me for contact, for you know, how to get, if I'm going to Salt Lake, where can I go? Well, I could tell them where the club is. But that's not what I'm going to do. If somebody asked me, or I could tell them where to meet against you. If somebody asked me for a contact, what I'll try to do is find somebody I know. And I'll call the person. I won't tell them to call the 800 number or the automatic answer. See, I won't call them that. You know, what I'll do is I'll say, I know a guy there. He's weird, but you can count on him. You can count on him. And that's what I do. And then that way, you know you're going to have a contact that's going to help the person get where they need to go. You know, that, to me, is an extremely important thing. We've institutionalized ourselves so much, we put ourselves in jail. You know, I was trying to get a contact, a very sensitive case, for a girl that was going up to Boston, and I really wanted to get hold of the right person to deal with a treacherous kind of a case like that. Called up there, called the intergroup, and I understood what they were saying. It's just that it just makes me sick that we're at that point. That she said, I understand what you're saying, that you really need a particular type of person. She said, but we can't give out that kind of information. I can't give you a phone number to call. You know, all I can do is tell you to call here, and then we'll hook her up with somebody. Well, my God, that's Russian roulette. You know, if you're dealing with a difficult kind of a case. And so those are the kind of things that, to me, are critical about the health and wellness of our fellowship, and why groups are so doggone important. Yeah.
Well, first of all, thanks for coming to visit with us.
Oh, pleasure.
Appreciate it. My question was about just for my home group's a closed meeting, a big book study, and obviously with we have people with other addictions and so forth that wander in, and they don't know the rules of closed meetings and so forth. But how do you handle or what's the good protocol for closed meetings versus open meetings for you know? The type of discussion, or what, or if somebody starts talking about heroin at an AA meeting, you know, a closed meeting, doesn't bother me because they don't know that they're not.
Well, I think you have to deal with it, and it's either that or just give up the notion that AA is for alcoholics. You know that I won't have time to elaborate on it much, but you know, I believe there's a basic fact about Alcoholics Anonymous that's built on. That when Bill met Bob in the gatehouse at the Cyberling Estate, you know that story, where AA, the magic happened. And when they got through meeting, the doctor said to the stockbroker, finally somebody understands. This is the physician saying to the stockbroker, somebody understands. And I think what formed that day was the basic tenet of Alcoholics Anonymous. Our whole program was predicated, developed on that belief, that when one alcoholic talks with another, something happens that's special. That's either true or it's not. If it's true, then I think we have an absolute responsibility to do everything we can to assure that the next alcoholic who walks in that door finds what we advertise. Alcoholics Anonymous, a safe place where you can go in and talk with your kind of people. And trust that what you do there will stay there. You know, and so I think you have to do it. There's a lot of ways. The worst way is publicly. The worst way. There are groups, and they're the ones that will tend to sound like the Jerry Springer Show, but there are groups that will just rudely, you know, say, oh, you don't belong here. You got a guy.
Right.
What a horrible way to treat somebody.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think when somebody comes in that door, I don't care who they are unless they're disrupting the meeting. I don't care who they are. At a minimum, this is Alcoholics Anonymous, for God's sake. This is not the Tea Party. You know, that this is the last stop on the bus line. So when somebody comes here, it's not because they're looking for a leisure time activity. You know, there's something going on. And so I think at a minimum, they need to get a warm welcome and loving, loving guidance to where they need to be. You know, as far as, you know, like doing it in a meeting. But I think it's very important to deal with that, to help people understand. Just like you said, people don't come in understanding this stuff. Yeah, it's our responsibility to deal with that thing and to deal with it as lovingly as we can. Now, let me add two other things about that real quick. Like the I have not had the problem in the group I've been in for the last 30 years. Zero problems. And the real key to it is the newcomer group that we're talking about. Our newcomer group meets at the same, like on Monday night, we break down into, we got groups all over the place, but we have two that are closed, one that's open. The open meeting is the newcomer meeting. It's open for a purpose, because when people come in, most people come in, unless they really, really got some experience, they don't tend to understand. If they've been through treatments, you can bet they're pretty well going to have multi-labels on them. You know, and this alcoholic addict thing is almost a one word. You know, if you've gone through that kind of experience. And I think it's our job to be patient with that and help them work it out. So in our group, if somebody comes in, we never have a time when there's not an open meeting available. Open speaker meeting obviously is open. The other meetings, we've always got one. If somebody comes to the wrong room, they'll say, hey, wait a minute, wrong room, next door. And so you got somewhere to go. And so that's been vital. You know, it's very simple, God knows. And so it solved that problem absolutely. We've had no problem, none. Because we've got a solution, and we can deal with it readily. Nobody's ever offended. And we make it our business to have information about NACA so we know how to help people get where they need to go. And so that's how we deal with it. Let me see if you want to say something.
Yeah, I'm more an alcoholic. My home group is the Big Uglies in Midville on Wednesday at nights. And one of the things that we do is everybody, it caters to the newcomers, this meeting. It's not a newcomer meeting, but they do cater to the newcomers, and we do get a lot of newcomers that come in through treatment centers. But we allow everybody to get up there and celebrate their birthdays, regardless of whatever. But just before the sharing portion of the meeting starts, we explain this is an open meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. However, sharing is limited to alcoholics. If you have a need other than alcoholism, please see the secretary after the meeting to get some information in literature or where you can go to get meetings of that nature. And so that's just kind of a how we handle it. And of course, we still get people up there who share from the podium who are not out, who, that's not their primary situation. It is what it is, you know? And I have yet to see anybody get up and mock one of them or say anything to them. There's been circumstances where there was an Al-Anon person, and they were sought out after the meeting and you know, privately shared with.
Yeah.
And I think that that's appropriate, in my opinion.
It is, yeah. I tell you, it can go a little bit better with the... One thing, we had a little break out there with, we had a new halfway house in town, and we started getting, what we started doing when we started asking people to participate, got to bear in mind that AA meetings are conducted by AA members. That's where a critical distinction. And so we started, if we weren't sure, and just say conversation, you're alcoholic, you know. And if say no, say, okay, that's all right, we'll get somebody else, you know. But it's not doing it publicly, it's doing it privately, you know. And you don't have to explain all of the reasons for that. Nobody's going to get heartbroken. But like most of the problems that we encounter are initiated by us, by the way we handle it. And so I think, you know, in a group where you've got, that's a good way to do it. But what's happened with us in that newcomer group, it has totally solved the problem. We deliberately have it meeting when the other groups are meeting, because otherwise it doesn't do any good. Yeah, Tony.
Yeah, my name's Tony. I'm an alcoholic. I don't publicly mock him, but I mock him under my breath. anyway,
Sneaky devil.
I'm fortunate because I believe I'm in a home group that lives by that upside triangle, and they're not just people who read the big book; they do it. And I think that's been a big importance in my recovery. But I've done the floater meetings, the brown bag meetings that you were talking about, and the open meetings, and less people are staying sober and getting the recovery because they're not all doing it the same like you were talking about when you went through the big book. And it can get pretty crazy for an alcoholic like me to be into those meetings, you know, and I attend them to try to find a newcomer and help, and maybe to pull them away and bring them to my home group and get them out of that situation. In the beginning, you had shared about how people were asking not to have treatment centers send. We've seen that here in Salt Lake where a meeting broke off from a large meeting, started only because the recovery people were taking up too much time to celebrate 30-day, 60-day, 90-day chips, and it was taken away from the message of hope. So I just want to share how solid and fortunate that I am that this guy came and asked me to join this particular home group. And I hear it from my sponsor all the time, you know, we all do it the same. And I can call when I have a problem. I can't go to my sponsor. I can call anybody in that home group, and I usually call three or four guys out of the home group, and I get the same answer. Mm-hmm. So I believe I have that quality of fellowship, recovery, and you know, the service home group. Mm-hmm. But I've been in those brown bag meetings, and I still go to them. And they're, man, it's not a good place for a new person to be. It's not a good place really for me to be.
Yeah.
Because I'll get these crazy ideas.
Mm-hmm.
No.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that, Tony. I tell you, it's a huge problem. And, you know, one thing I like, structure. Structure solves stuff, and you don't have to have so many moving parts. You know, if you got a system of work, you don't have to be fine-tuned and handling every case. You know, you got a system to do it. One other thing I want to mention about the anybody. Well, let me mention this right quick, men. I don't have to quit at 4:30. But I got to go to jail, and Pete will tell me when. The one thing to think about, I thought about when you mentioned about open meetings. You know, one of the things that's been also a byproduct of this movement toward that kind of to meeting, for all practical purposes, they effectively block out the family. You know, that you know, I believe, it doesn't make it true, but I believe that alcoholism truly is a family illness. It doesn't happen to one person. That's shared in by every alcoholic. It affects anywhere from 5 to 10 other people. Seriously affects that many people, and so we're not in this by ourselves. You know that, and the family is critical, not only in the illness but in the recovery. And what happens as we move toward this, the best I can tell, well, and I can tell pretty well, and I've verified it with some Al-Anon people. Al-Anon is dying on the vine. It is absolutely just shrinking. I was in a conference convention not a month ago. Now listen to these numbers. You see what I'm talking about. In that conference, there were 3,888 registered participants. 3,888. There were 145 members of Al-Anon. A little disparity in that. Al-Ateen. Now, if you want to see somebody that's emotional about kids, you can mention kids in an AA meeting, people start tearing up. Our hearts go out everywhere except trying to help them in Al-Ateen. There were 25 Al-Ateen members at that convention. So I'm talking about that the whole notion of the family program is just diminishing. And I think that's troubling, you know, that's happening. Like, if you go to, it's a strange thing, next time you go to a conference and they have an Al-Ateen, a lot of times they have an Al-Ateen program, next time you go to one, drop in on the Al-Ateen meeting. You will not have any trouble finding a seat. You'll see kids up there pouring their hearts out, scared to death, maybe a dozen people listening to them. I sat in an Al-Ateen meeting one day, and an Al-Anon lady came up to me and she said, "You won't believe what my daughter told me." I'm just sitting in there, just a lump on the tree. And the daughter ran and called her mother, and she said, "You know who's sitting in our Al-Ateen meeting?" She said, "Who?" She said, "Tommy." Well, that probably didn't mean anything to her mother. It did to the kid. You know. But you see what I'm talking about? You know, what does it say about family program? When you got people pouring their hearts out, scared to death, and ignore them, treat them like a fire plug, for God's sakes. Yeah.
Oh, you can finish. I'll finish after you.
I'm never finished. I just quit.
My name's Yvonne, and I am an alcoholic. I apologize for not introducing myself properly.
I knew you were. I could tell.
That's why I'm here. Yeah. And I started out my... I started in a treatment center and did their 28-day program at Highland Ridge. That is my home group. I do go back. I'm actually going over there at 5 o'clock today to pick up my one-year chip. And I have 1 year and 12 days of sobriety.
Congratulations.
Thank
yeah.
you.
Yeah.
I started out in Highland Ridge.
Is it a real, is it an AA group?
It is an AA group.
All right.
Yes, it's in the treatment center. And the people that are still in treatment come to those meetings. And when he was saying the treatment centers take up the time introducing the newcomers and the 90 days, 30 days, or 30 days, whatever, you know, to me it's,
that's
life.
Good. Do you pay rent? Do you pay rent?
I have paid out the notice to be there.
Yeah. Nami, do you pay rent? Does the group pay rent to the facility?
Oh, I don't know that. I don't know what.
So stick it in the back of your mind, because you're a bright, inquisitive woman. You stick it in the back of your mind.
I'm not sure if they do or not, but I would.
Well, don't worry about it. Just keep it in the back of your mind and take a look, because you may be able to give some help to that. A lot of times what happens is we'll wind up affiliating, you know, rather than cooperating. We'll wind up affiliating. So that you couldn't tell the difference between where treatment stops and AA starts. And when we do that, we compromise both. And so it's a lot of groups meet in treatment centers. The real criteria is that it be a self-supporting group of Alcoholics Anonymous and not just another name for an aftercare program. Okay. All right. Good deal. I'll just throw that caution out. Just stick it back there and think about it. Okay. Yeah.
It is AA.
My name is Andrew. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Andrew.
You spoke of the lack of participation from the fellowship and the general service structure. And I was just, it's a big concern I have. You know, they say 10% does 90% of the work in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I can see from a home group level, you know, what you spoke of, how to be effective. I've served as an alternate DCM. I'm currently serving as a DCM. It's really frustrating for me to try to spark an interest when I visit groups and you know, try to offer my services and the information available to the group, and man, I never get a bite. And so I was just wondering, do you have any ideas about, you know, how we could help?
I've been in the same.
I guess the fellowship filled a responsibility to assume some of those responsibilities.
Well, I think one thing, doing what I'm doing here today,
uh-huh.
I mean, I'm treading into some sticky ground, and everybody doesn't feel this way. But I think those of us who really have a strong sense of this have a responsibility to share that and see if we can recruit people to the concern. And so that's one. The other, and I've been in that position, man. I have been to a district committee and go to a meeting and have six people come out of 30 groups. And so you see where that two-thirds comes from. And it is a terribly, terribly discouraging thing. I really believe that is, you won't solve it top down. That is just exactly what Bill laid out with the inverted triangle. The home group has got to drive that. You know, in all honesty, in our group, we have to block vote. We get people go and they'll lobby a little bit. We block vote to keep from dominating the district, because our group is strong, and we'd be DCM in perpetuity. You know, if we didn't do that, so we have to plan how to avoid, you know, just making it to our home group instead of a district. So the idea of if you can just get people, if you don't have home groups, you're just fighting an uphill battle. You don't do a meeting conference, you got to have a group conference. But that is a tough deal. And trying to find people with answers for that, I don't know, just giving it my very best, make sure that I'm as well informed as I can be, that my home group is a well-informed group that's conscious about trying to take care of fellowship. I can do that, and then try to be supportive of what we do. But otherwise, I've been in that battle, and it's a tough. Yeah.
I'm Liz, and I'm an alcoholic. I actually bring a meeting to a treatment center. It's called AA Wraps. It's a speaker meeting, and I make sure to read the preamble beforehand about our not being affiliated. And I also try to suggest meetings that I attend in two of my home groups, that if I'm telling people to go to meeting, that I should try to be there myself. And I also get speakers that I make sure they have some sobriety, that they're working the AA program, not some, you know, figment of their imagination.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think it's important to, but I didn't start out that way. You start taking responsibility for these service positions.
Mm-hmm.
That you get, and I mean, it's important. I only have 2 years of sobriety,
mm-hmm.
so I pretty much tried to make sure it's not Liz's program of recovery that I bring in.
Mm-hmm.
And I try to pray to God and make sure that I bring him along to that meeting.
Yeah.
A lot of the times, you know, and I try not to have an opinion, because I have a lot of opinions, and I don't think they're going to be of any use for someone
mm-hmm.
with all I have is my experience and how that I'm sober. And I hope people in a treatment center can say, well, how come you're sober and I'm not? Because I'm an alcoholic.
And I'm
leaving the treatment center, and you all aren't. You know, I mean, that's...
Yeah, real trick is to trade opinions for experience, because you've got experience. Opinions are absolutely useless. Everybody's got one. But when you talk experience, that's what communicates them. And yeah, I don't care if it's 30 minutes, you know. I'll tell you one little illustration of that. I mentioned up at Lava Lake. I was on a plane one day, and a guy... Guy sitting beside me was just terrified, you know. And I just decided to, I started to leave him alone, you know, not mess with him. But you could tell that guy was absolutely scared to death. And I just leaned over a little bit and I said, rough, ain't it? He said, and he just came up, man, he came unglued. He said, my God, man, you don't know how rough it is. He said, I am so terrified every time we take off and land. I don't know what to do, and I have to travel. I cover the entire country. I have to fly. And he said, I don't know what I'm going to do. And I said, now it was a little bit of a lie, but if it's spiritually intended, I think a lie is okay. And it wasn't a total lie. I said, you know, I had that problem. I didn't tell it was for 10 seconds one time, but it was true. That was experience. And I knew that feeling for a brief interval. And he said, "What'd you do?" And I said, "Well, I belong to a program, and we use a little prayer that's the best remedy I could ever imagine, and it works." He said, "What's the prayer?" And he said, "I did." So I recited the Serenity Prayer. And he said, "Say that again." So I said it again. He said, "Wait a minute." And he got his pad out. Every salesman got a pad. Got the cat out. He said, "Tell me that one more time." So, you see, that's the value of experience. Now, if I'd have just started giving him advice, "I don't think you ought to be scared. You know, these airplanes are well built." He didn't care who built it. Christ could have built it. He wouldn't have cared. He won't off that dude. That's why I think experience is so important, that just come from that. And nobody can argue with it. It's your experience.
I think that's all we have, isn't it? I mean,
yeah.
That's all I have.
Sure it is. You got a lot of other stuff, but it's mostly useless. Yeah.
My name's John. I'm an alcoholic.
John.
And listening to Andrew's question, I'm a DCF too, District 8, Eastern Utah there. And the reason I'm in service is because of what you've been talking about. Watching newcomers go into meetings, and it's like watching somebody walk into quicksand. And it's frustrating. There are so many groups that don't have home group structure.
Yeah.
And implementing structure into a group that doesn't have structure. I was fired at GSR in a meeting to try to do that.
That's hard to achieve.
That didn't do anything about my frustration. Yeah. And watching people come and go and come and go and go and not be able to come back.
Yeah.
But anyway, there are things you can do at meeting level. Because the meetings are about recovery, say, you know, and if you try to inject service, you get, you know, kind of pushed out of the way. Or if you try to work in unity, you know, it puts back into recovery, those kind of things. But, you know, I think a big deal about our service structure, and I saw this in action within our District 8. What we used to do after our district meetings, we had another hour-long meeting, and they read the concepts for an hour. It was like amazing to watch people just kind of go with their eyes crossed. And
it'll empty a room, won't it?
I don't think it did the district that well. So what we did was we said, let's quit reading the concepts for a minute and let's start reading the AA group pamphlet and learn about the actual structure of Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. And what was amazing was we started out with like six people. Within a couple of months, we were having 18, 20, 25 people, and they were interested in seeing what each position did, what, you know, how the positions interrelated, a greeter, why we have a greeter, those kind of things.
Sure.
And education came through the service structure, and, you know, I got a long way. I hope I don't die for a long time. Mm-hmm. There are going to be Alcoholics Anonymous groups over in Vernal and Roosevelt. But we did that, okay, and a lot of people that have been sober 12, 14, 16 years that have gotten away from the structure and came back were amazed at what they learned. I'm always amazed when I open up that pamphlet, something else comes out. And
we moved from it's good stuff, John.
But anyway, that aspect, if you talk a little more to that, you know, we don't have a lot of people in service, but if the people that we have in service understand the structure and can relate that to other people through their experiences, that makes a big difference.
Yeah. Well, you're a little creative. You know, alcoholics think it's dangerous, but there's a lot of creativity in it. You know, and so if you get folks thinking about the idea, that, you remember that guy I was talking about had the umbilical to the treatment center, and I told him he's going out to get service? He became DCM. Didn't want to, but he did. And he became DCM. And I told him I'd take alternate if we'd double team it and see what we could do. And the point is, it's kind of like we're talking about on what can you do. Now we pumped it up. There's no question about that. You know, we had one district meeting. Normally had six. We had one group district meeting. Had 132 people there because we started having. You know, if you look at the typical kind of a district meeting, it's a grunt and groan session. You know, it's probably a problem focus, and that does not attract anything much. And so we pumped it up. We had a CPCI panel, and had packed in 132 people in the meeting. And now the downside of that is that people come just to see the dog and pony show, don't tend to come back. Some do though. So you get a little bit of a bump, and you get information out. So there are creative things, you know, like that that you can do that are sort of liven the agenda. Because if you evaluate what's happening in a meeting and ask yourself, who would that attract? You know, and so it, like a business meeting in our group, one night I was sitting in a group and I just asked a little rhetorical question. I said, anybody know why we have good business meetings? And we do. So anybody know why we have good business meetings? And nobody knew. I said, it's because we talk about what we do. We don't talk about a whole bunch of grunting and groaning and stuff. We talk about what we do. And I tell you, I think the most valuable work of the service committees is not what's delivered, but what happens when people are putting together what's delivered. Because, man, that is really, you know, football games are won on Tuesday at practice. They're not won on Saturday when you kick off. And that's the same thing with this. When you get people creatively working on trying to get solution-oriented, it'll energize stuff. But the downside is that it'll tend to drop back, you know, if there's not, you know, some method for carrying it on. So, yeah, thanks, John, for bringing that up. I guess, Peter, are we gonna have to quit? Or are we going to cheat or what?
Yeah, well, we've got to leave about 5 after, so let's get
cut things down
so you can visit for a few before we leave.
All right, okay.
So we just don't run out the door.
Yeah.
I just have a quick question. I'm Kimberly, an alcoholic.
Okay.
Our home group is A Way Out, and it's a home group. The thing that disturbs me sometimes with groups or home groups is that you'll have a business meeting, somebody will show up that never comes and make their opinion, and then you'll never see them again. What do you do in that situation in your home group?
Vote.
Revote?
We vote.
Or do you have a criteria for home group members? Do they have to be there in order to
just be
to
a
vote?
Member. We have a list of our home group members. And
what if they show up, make a decision, and leave? What do you do? Like,
that's all right. We don't have a police force. And if a person is a member, if they say they're a member, you know, if they have the criteria, we don't have a police force. And but we can outvote them, for God's sake, you know. Yeah. If you got a group that's pretty thoughtful, and I mean, you can spot a diggling a mile away, and you just have to do a little block vote.
Can we tell them not to vote? No, I'm just kidding.
I let them vote. I tell you, but it's. I don't know why I thought of it, but you're talking about voting. There's a leadership thing, you know. It's like when you're doing DCM thing and stuff like that. People watch what you do. If you have over 5 years of this program, I guarantee you, you're a leader. Whether you want to be or not, you don't have to sign up for it. You're a leader, and people look to you to see how you do AA. And I tell you what brought it home to me. What I was in an area office position at an assembly, and we had some no-brainer issue on the table. It wasn't worth talking about. And I kept voting for it because I wanted to get it gone. You know, I kept voting. Well, I saw that it wasn't working, so I turned it around. I said, do it the other way. I threw it out the back door, and I voted against it. Now, 300 people probably in there. I couldn't have told you how anybody voted. I'll bet you I had at least 25 people ask me why I voted, why I changed my vote. You know, people look to people. You don't have to be elected to something to be a leader. You know, if you're senior in this program, who are you going to look to? And so I mean, I think the real responsibility goes with that too, you know. But that's the thing with voting, you know, that's it's tricky terrain. But I think you're in a good, solid group. Somebody was running wild like that. It's too obvious. They're not going to screw up too much, I don't think. Anyway, there's nothing we can do about it. We can't fire them. Anybody else anything for Peter? Yeah.
Well, John, alcoholic. One more last question. It kind of comes back to what you were talking about at first. I've seen old timers that have the attitude that the people coming through the treatment centers are somehow less sober or not as good as the old school guys that just came in out of, you know, off the streets and so on and so forth. And it seems to be a little bit of maybe condescension to the treatment. And I know the treatment stuff's a lot of loving and hugging and stuff. I came through one myself. I mean, I went to the hospital and I went to treatment. So my question is, you know, in talking maybe to the old timers about that, and I realize it's a shock to their system, but how do you help them understand that, hey, we got here one way or the other, you know. We didn't come in off the street, but we came through the hospital, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So forth.
Yeah, well, take them in for one thing. Get them introduced is one way to do it. And others ignore them. You got some people retire from AA, but unfortunately don't go away. You know what I mean? They just quit AA, and they just show up ritually and sit there and never engage in anything except criticism. I had a guy that's, I think he's 45 years sober. We had a speaker a week or so ago. He comes to our group once in a while. He doesn't have a home group. Doesn't want one. Don't think he got a sponsor. He had one, but he died. And came to me, and so I greeted him, and I said, man, that was a good talk, wasn't it? He said, oh, basic. I said, but that was a good talk, wasn't it? Well, you know, it was the same stuff. I said, well, let me tell you something. I thought that was one of the finest AA talks I've heard for a long time, because I listened to an alcoholic tell a story about the hopelessness of the illness and the miracle of recovery. Now, I don't know what you think about that, but I thought that was a heck of a job. And he didn't have much more to say. You know, he had suddenly got a phone call or something. But now I can do that, you know, because I'm senior to him, so he has to listen for a little while and talk about me later. You know. But I think sometimes you got to do that. I don't understand why it is, but a lot of old people, when they do, I say they retire. I mean, they just stay there. But they're totally out of the process, and it's just sort of a ritualistic showing up. And it maybe have some value to just come in and associate with people. But if you start looking for some kind of leadership or aggressive kind of development or working with new people, that's probably not the guy you're going to try to ask. Because you're not going to help much people much with that kind of stuff. So sometimes I think you just got to do that. I tell you one thing that I've found is a lot of newcomers feel useless. I mean, old-timers, I mean, feel useless. That a lot of times old-timers, people don't want to hear from them because it seems too heavy when it comes down. What I found is that the opposite of what I was just describing about that one guy is to get old-timers together and say, what do you think? What do you think? You know, about some issue of concern. What do you think? Because for many old timers, it's the first time they've heard the question in years. It may be their thought, but what we do is let them drift off into uses. They've got valuable stuff. They've got experience, just like we were talking about, that they've got experience to draw from. And so that's one way that I try to do is just get them engaged so that they're interacting with what we're doing.
Yeah. I've found that, I mean, that's just part of my experience. I still go to my aftercare group because the guy that's employed by the hospital is an AA member, 20-some-odd years, and we talk a lot of AA in there, you know, about meetings and sponsorship, and, you know, trying to pass the message that way. And so for me, it's been great, you know, but mm-hmm. we kind of get the attitude that, well, you're maybe a little less than, you know, mm-hmm. your quality of sobriety is maybe not as great as ours because we did it the hard way or something.
I think that was part of that is a reaction to what happened early on when treatment first came. There was a ripple of conversation that went through AA. And I don't know who is you, it doesn't matter. You know, it was either us or it might have been the treatment industry, but there were an awful lot of people who said, like, going to treatment is equivalent to 1 year of recovery or 5 years of recovery. And, God, it's just like I said earlier, going to treatment is to get prepared to engage in recovery. But it was that kind of thing that when people heard that, you know, some would believe it just because they came out of treatment and they knew some words and they sounded smart. You know, didn't realize it during the first day of recovery. And so I think some of that may be backlash to say, there's already much of that. You know. Yeah, John.
There's a quote that Pete likes to mention a lot. I think it puts that concept in a perspective that makes it easier to see the idea of people coming out of treatment versus the people that came in off of the street. And it's that an alcoholic at his absolute very best is the elite of the mentally ill. When I hear that, it kind of puts it in perspective. You know,
but on behalf of old timers, let me tell you one thing. That, yeah, I'm the oldest active member, a male member in my state. There's some women that push me around that are older than me. But there is a real responsibility that goes with that, with being an old timer. It may have something to do with it. Like I mentioned about that newcomer meeting, a guy that's coming up on 52 years of sobriety is an intimidating thing to consider. And so I have to watch it because I'm a very active member. And I'm probably not a good role model for most members. And so I have to watch that I don't let my persuasive kind of energy get in the way of good, sound group conscience. And so I have to be very mindful about holding back and not being the guy with every idea. And so there are two sides to that thing about why old timers get into that. Now I'm not a nice enough guy to back off. They'll have to push me off. But I'm just one of those kind of guys here. But there are two sides of that. Well, I think we're gonna have to leave. And y'all want to pray or something? What do you do when you end a meeting here? Deep dunk people or something like? All right, a bunch of infidels don't want to pray. I'm going to tell everybody that don't pray in Salt Lake.